Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete. Ignorance is bliss.
I don't know what that means in this situation, but I do know we got a big stack, a big books going on this week to talk about, so I don't want to waste any time jumping right into it with X-Men number 35 from Marvel.
Ooh, big one.
Written by Jerry Duggan, Kieran Gillen, Al Ewing, Chris Claremont, Gail Simone, Jed McKay, art by Joshua Cassara, Phil Noto, Lucas Wernick, Lineal Francis Yu, Walter Simonson, Mark Brooks, John Romita Jr., Jerome Opeña, Luciano Vecchio, Stefano Caselli, Sarah Pacelli, Salvador Larraca, and Javier Garon. This is officially, finally, wrapping up the Krakoa era in style with a big fight with all of the X-Men and Apocalypse, wrapping up a bunch of other stuff there as well. And then it's kicking us directly in the final pages into the next era of the X-Men with a little preview of what's to come down the road with the new titles. Pete, I do actually want to go to you first because you have beaten the Krakoa era. It's done. It's wrapped up. And now we're kicking it to the next era. How are you feeling?
Well, great. Great question. First off, just want to say it's issue number 700 of X-Men. So that's a pretty huge deal.
It's X-Men number 35. They legacy numbered it for Uncanny X-Men number 700, which is one of the more bonkers legacy numberings they've done. But still, congratulations. These people very specifically have all been working very hard.
For
700 months
now. Issue 700, yeah.
Really weird.
Crazy.
An amazing cover. I thought it was cool. It was like a fun, like, you know, finding your favorite hero and stuff like that. And I loved where Deadpool was on the bird there. Weird placement of the eyeball, though.
Do you have any opinions other than the cover?
Yeah, I was going to say, you can always tell when Pete likes a book. When Pete likes a book, when he dwells on the cover for half of his review.
I'm going to get there.
Staples are solid in this one. Shiny.
Here we go. I mean, they're working so hard to use Cypher and make Cypher feel relevant. I mean, it is just like,
man, they need to make him feel
battle. You know what I mean? And then they're finally like, hey, Hump Islands, why don't you two work it out? We'll put Cypher in the middle for a little Cypher sandwich, and then we'll watch you transform into something that's not sexual, because we won't say that on there, even though people might be thinking it, so we're going to call it out there.
Pete, yeah. The roast of Krakoa is actually next weekend. So, like, Comedy Central's the roast
Jeff
of Krakoa.
Ross wasn't available tonight, unfortunately.
It's weird. Yeah. It seems like if you're going to do a roast, he would be the first person you would check with.
Exoswords or tennis swords? I don't know. You tell me.
But, yeah, this was a hell of an issue. I enjoyed a lot of it. Thought it was fucked up when, and spoilers here, Nightcrawler ripping eyeballs, you know what I mean? You know, you've seen the Patrick Swayze throat rip. This is the first time I'm seeing Nightcrawler use the old eyeball pop move on Apocalypse, and it doesn't really seem to faze him. I loved a lot of what's happening here. I mean, it broke my heart the way they threw Wolverine aside like a piece of tinfoil. But, I'm excited to see what's going to happen. I had some fun during this issue, and I'm excited to see what's going to happen.
It's a shame having tinfoil bones grafted that Pete has tin bones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When they did that, why do you think Weapon X did that? They laced his bones with tinfoil. Was it just to wrap them? Like for cooking?
No, so it stays
they're
fresh.
Leftovers. Yeah.
You keep it fresh. You know what I mean? But,
your time is over. You've said what you needed to say. Let's turn to the people who like this era. Justin,
I'm sure
over
this
to
is
you.
Something you guys are going to talk about, right? Like, you had to be excited. Like, maybe we should get two characters who never just talk to each other, Charles Xavier and Magneto. Let's have them talk it out a little bit. You know
what
I mean?
That was great, and you're wrong. Now,
I can't even tell if you don't like it or you do.
I made a mistake here at the top of the show.
Did you make a mistake? Did you feel it?
No, I wanted you to, like, get it out so you don't yell, like, squeeze the poison out, but that's clearly not what happened. You're like, no, I'm gonna suck the poison back into myself and make myself all poisoned. Over to Justin for work commentary on X-Men number 35.
It's nice we can remove Pete's whole review in a chunk in that.
I mean, all he talked about was the cover, so it's all right.
And all glowing. I mean, Pete, definitively we got, are we watching Island Sex? And yeah. Cypher was like, definitely not. So, in your face. They're not, it's more of a dry humping than anything, really.
Oh, okay, cool. I'm glad we're spending time on it. You know what I mean? I just think it's important.
No, you already talked.
I do think it's interesting. To wrap up Krakoa and have it be so much about Apocalypse, I thought was sort of strange. And I don't know what that means for the future. It's where we end up, and we are going to be talking spoilers here, is Apocalypse is on Arako, and that's, like, going to be a place. We get Krakoa is vanishing, but it's being sort of pushed out onto the ice in its own complete form, so it can be revisited later. But we didn't really get into a lot of the underlying philosophies of Krakoa. It definitely felt like sort of, we're going to bring this back to more X-Men continuity, classic X-Men continuity in this issue as well, not just shifting to it. It's like, no, this is going to be a fight from a villain that you know that is vaguely philosophical, but it's mostly about just like he's becoming a villain again. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I feel a little conflicted about this issue, and that sounds like you're the same, Justin. Just, they're teeing up. There's another miniseries. There's like
same for me.
There's these vestigial miniseries and one shots that are coming out, which is just part and parcel for how comics are published. But it's like the Krakoa era is over, except for this miniseries called Heir of Apocalypse that's coming out for the next couple of months and kind of straddles both things. And also these Blood Hunt one shots that are coming out that are like kind of one thing but not another. And we're seeing one of them this week with the Wolverine one. And it's like, I don't know. I wish we could just have an ending, you know, and then move on to the next thing rather than everything be this current wash. And I understand I'm tilting at Wilton Mills here because that's what comic books are. But
yeah, that was going to be what I was going to say.
At the same time, I think like I appreciated in a certain sense forgetting about the era of Apocalypse thing and Apocalypse fights, because it is this thing that's been weighing over the whole era of like, yeah, I get that you're welcoming all mutants on Krakoa, but Apocalypse? Really? Is that what we're doing here? So I think that was the idea there even more than kicking off the new miniseries. But at the same time, it's very much all middle rather than closure.
Yeah, and like you're saying, that is comics. Even it ends with, like, so ends the first Krakoan age. So it's, like, all wide open. And, like, we do get some nice, like, after the main story, we get a lot of, there's a nice panel where, like, everyone's crying. Exodus is crying, like, some sick tears. That guy needs, he's got to be dehydrated from the White Hot Room in general. And he's, like, full tears in this issue. But we get a lot of, like, short bits that I think were, like, a series of post-credit sequences, essentially, that I think do the work that I want this book to be doing. We get some nice Mystique Justice here. We get Professor X just, I don't know what's happening here. Let's talk about that. He gets Magneto sort of saves him, and then he gets punished, quote unquote, in a giant jail cell. Where he just gets to do whatever he wants. I thought was interesting and a cool idea. But then by the end of the book, that gets washed away as well. Because he escapes.
I actually really... No, he doesn't escape. I guess we'll see what happens. But like, well, no, we'll see what happens. We know what happens. He is going to be imprisoned in the Westchester Institute school. Westchester School. They've turned it into a prison for a bunch of folks, but very specifically him. He's like Prisoner X is whatever they're calling him. So he's basically like in a Magneto prison for the movies, except for Professor Xavier. That's where he's going to end up. But I don't know. I kind of liked where they left Professor X almost more than anything, taking him to a place where, like, ultimately he did save everybody, but he did horrible things to get there and said, you know what, take me in, it's fine. But the whole move with him saying, Tony Stark, Reed Richards, who are off screen the entire time, they built the perfect prison for me. Again, same as like the metal prison from X2 for Magneto. I feel like it's very similar thing there. But for
he becomes a human Cerebro when he's there.
Exactly. And he's blocked off there, but he's like, well, but I kind of maybe gave them a little bit of a psychic suggestion so I can have it out there. So similar to what I was saying earlier with it being all middle, that's what they're doing here, where it's not like Professor Xavier is in prison. It's Professor Xavier is in prison unless. And same thing with every single part of it. It's like they took down Apocalypse, except. And again, I think you could give closure even in a comic book company like a Marvel or DC. You could end things and then restart them again.
Yeah.
But that's not what they're doing here. They're just barreling straight through. And I don't know. Maybe it's a sales strategy. I'm just not sure.
Well, yeah, it's like the story continues. I will say the more definitive parts are what I liked. Like, we get all of the story where Professor X is visiting all the students. There's some good writing here where we get like the pattern of "to me, my X-Men" in a bunch of out of different people's mouths, meaning different things. I actually thought that was cute.
Kitty Pryde bit where what did she do? She's like, to me, my ex, man.
I know, it's great. Yeah, I actually like that.
This is cute.
It's very writerly. It's a little like efforted, but I thought it was cool.
No, but I love like, the setups. I don't know if it's just the two of them, but it's very much the combo of Jed McKay and Gail Simone being like, we're cute, funny writers. Here you go. And great. That one line, I was like, this is silly.
Yeah.
But it definitely got me way more on board for the new X-Men era than almost anything else.
And I love the tonal differences here. We get like Cyclops doing big X-Men stuff, building a new headquarters. Rogue and Gambit, cute rom-com, love that. The Kitty Pryde stuff, she's out on her own. It feels different. It feels specific. And then the little flashes we get at like Wolverine, Forge, everything feels cool. The one interesting one, like Jean Grey's Phoenix again, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's weird. How is that going to fit?
You know, it's interesting. Tom Brevoort, I know I bring up his newsletter all the time, but he's been I'm just going to answer 100 questions here about stuff every single week, which is wild. So he talked about, I'm probably misquoting him here, or I'm certainly paraphrasing, but he was like, Jean Grey's resurrection was one of the biggest mistakes that comics ever made. And because that becomes her whole thing. So I think that kind of plays out here in terms of, I don't know who she is. I don't know who she is as a character. I don't necessarily need like cosmic Jean Grey or anything like that. So I'm very curious to see how that book pans out in particular, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Art's great as well.
Yes. I did want to mention that like there's a bunch of killer one page splashes throughout here from like John Romita Jr. and Walt Simonson and a couple of other people. Awesome, awesome art book. So even if I'm conflicted about it, it's still a nice twight package, right, Pete?
It was interesting we spent a lot.
It's worth it for a big kind of event issue.
It was interesting. We get like the heart of the book is this big Chris Claremont story with Nightcrawler, Destiny, Mystique, and Rogue, which I thought was cool that they gave it that time. And it does feel like they're sort of saying, and we're going to leave this for a little while as well.
Well, and also that was, I think the specific idea there was, it was Chris Claremont's idea back in the day that Nightcrawler would be Destiny and Mystique's kid, and they didn't let him do it. So they finally let him write that dynamic, and like it's very classic Claremontisms throughout all the dialogue and everything. But I agree. I appreciate it. It's like, hey, man, we're going to give you the time to do the thing that you always wanted to do for decades and never got to do. Cool with me.
And it's sneakily just sort of being like, and here's how the continuity works. It's sort of like, actually, Professor X didn't know. He hid the secret from himself. And then this and then that. And I was like, oh, okay. But I still enjoyed it.
Yeah. good stuff. I know you're not Pete, but I really am going to miss the Krakoa era. I thought it was big, bold storytelling. But based on this, I'm excited for what comes next. Speaking of what comes next, let's
talk
about...
Here's a Pete treat.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Alpha from IDW, written by Jason Aaron and Tom Waltz, art by Chris Burnham and Gavin Smith. We're getting two stories in here. The backup story is about Old Hab and him gathering a bunch of people in a mutant nation. But the main draw here, nothing against the backup story, is we are finally getting our first peek at Jason Aaron's run on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And of course, as one of the turtles, who I know by name, but I'm not going to say.
Donatello.
Sure.
By name.
I don't know. I can't tell them apart.
Says his name.
I'm racist towards turtles. I'm admitting it on the podcast right here.
No.
He has been imprisoned and forced to fight for his life to the point that he's forgetting his name. I'll tell you what, this book made me even more hyped for Jason Aaron's run. Great stuff from Chris Burnham as well. Bring it on.
I agree. I thought this was fun. Pete, you go last, remember? This is fun. I agree as well. The Jason Aaron stuff, I like how specific it is, focused. And it makes sense. Alex would forget his name. He's even forgetting his own name. It's a very forgettable situation. And then
who are you talking about? Who's this Alex?
Yeah. Wow. Finally. The mutant town stuff at the end. I really like Jenica. Of the Turtles verse, I think is cool, and I'm excited to see more of that. This story gets wild, though. It feels like absolutely not even a Turtles thing. With like spider scientist and like whole thing. I was like, what is this?
And then Pete, you can take it away, but the backup story feels to me like what IDW has been doing with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles all along. And Jason Aaron very clearly has been like, I'm not going to contradict any of that. They've been doing great stuff. I'm not interested. Yes, I am Pete. The crazy
this is the most Pete
guy.
Character I've ever seen. Look, Pete, you're featured in this comic. They drew you in.
What I want out of Turtles is the front story, like the Jason Aaron story. That's what I want. Like simplicity, intensity. It feels like straight out of the Eastman Laird original era. I thought it was great. Pete, take it away.
Yes, I agree with everything that you guys are saying here. It does feel gritty, which the Eastman and Laird was. So excited for the start of this. You got Donatello kind of also feels like Raph a little bit, where he's this grizzled fighter who's volunteering all the time for this kind of cage match style thing that happens, where for $5,000 you can fight for your life. Doesn't that sound fun? I just think that the artwork really reflects that time period in such a great way. I'm happy to kind of be back in this kind of gritty, originally black and white drawn story about ninjas and family. I'm excited for what Jason Aaron's going to do. And then the kind of like mutant island people living with fury, furries kind of world, very kind of cool and unique. So I'm excited to see furries. What that's going to be moving forward.
They're mutants.
Yeah, it's Mutant Island with furries.
Right. Furries are human. I know you don't care about humans. Like, you always fast forward past the humans.
You hate
humans. So, like, furries are humans who dress up as animals. These are, like, hybrid people.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm the only guy who wants to watch a Godzilla movie for Godzilla. I'm the only guy.
What are you fast forwarding through anything? Why you don't need to do that? Why? Just watch.
And yeah, just watch it on YouTube at that point, I guess, because you just want to watch YouTube clips because you're a kid who needs to inject candy directly into his veins.
And of course you know about furries because you spent some time as a human sexual dog.
Wow. So many podcasts getting mixed right now all together. Oh, it's like some sort of hybrid stew. The ultimate
shout to the Preacher podcast where we explored Pete's past, his sexual,
shouts
his sexual
to, past. Shouts to a sweet tooth, speaking of hybrids.
Shouts to The Sopranos. We haven't done a podcast about
that yet. Shouts to Stanley.
Oh, man. Stanley? Shouts to Stan Lee, R.I.P. The Ultimates, number one for Marvel, written by Dennis Capp, art by Juan Fergari. This is bringing together the Ultimate Super Team or the Ultimate Universe and picking up on the plot thread.
This was Justin's pick on the podcast.
I'm aware. Tony Stark is trying to repair the Ultimate Universe. We've seen that a little bit in Ultimate Spider-Man and others, where he's been sending missives out to folks to try to get them to be the heroes they need to be, because they are running out of time to stop the Maker when he eventually breaks out of the city they've trapped him in. That's what this is all a countdown to. Justin, I believe I've heard around the scuttlebutt. This is what you're going to pick on the live show. What'd you think about this?
This book has to do a lot of stuff because the continuity is wild here. You've got the Maker, the 2-year ticking time. We've got Reed Richards from this universe in a Doctor Doom mask hanging around. There's young Tony Stark. There's Iron Lad. We introduced some moloids, some moloid like racism happening here, which I thought was interesting.
Up, man.
So I like all this, and I'm very curious now that we've sort of sifted through a lot of the business and the like sending the snow globes that give you powers to different people. Great gift.
Yeah.
The moving out of this, I think, is really exciting. A pet peeve of mine is I think Ant-Man and the Wasp are like my least favorite Avengers. Mm. So like I'm ready to we get that out of the way here.
Oh, man. Don't tell Langston. Yeah, I think that this is like, first off, the only thing that you mentioned, forgot to mention, was Cap on Ice there. That was kind of a fun moment. But the art's unbelievable in this. I don't know how excited I am for what's being teed up here. They kind of had to get through a lot to kind of get it there. But yeah, I mean, the team alone is kind of worth checking it out for.
I was very surprised how much this leans into the multiverse of it all, to the point that they're not just talking about, but literally looking at the regular Marvel universe. And they're like, this is what we got to aspire
That's
to.
Cool.
We
got
to do this. That's cool. Which is the story that they're telling. Yeah. But at the same time, it's surprising to me to see that so blatantly put out there. It's also very interesting to blatantly be like Hank Pym not wanting to be the guy who hit Janet Van Dyne. And they never explicitly say that, but if you're a comic book reader, you know exactly what they're talking about at all points. Yeah. So I don't know. This is a very different feeling book than the other Ultimate books. And ultimately, like we talked about, no pun intended, that's what I want out of this line, is something that doesn't feel like something I've read before. This does not feel like the previous Ultimates. This does not feel like an Avengers book.
True.
I'm interested to follow this. I'm curious to see what happens next.
It's wild that Sif is like Weekend at Bernie's-ing Thor through this whole issue. And he's like, he's dying. And then he's like, I want to go fight. Come on. Sew my shirt together. And he goes out and fights. Like, that was cool. Interesting. I agree. It's very like postmodern and weird to have heroes be like, in this other universe, I was this way, but now I'm this way. I was like, wow, that's right on the nose of what the Ultimates are. Yeah, I just want to hear. I want to be more of an ultimate version of that guy. It's like, okay,
also, I'm cool. curious to see how this pans out, because there's a very like casual blink and you miss it paddle where Captain America is doing the beheading thing that John Walker was basically excommunicated for on Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Remember when that was a whole thing where he chopped a guy's head off with a shield? There's a paddle of Captain America doing that here that nobody refers to or cares about in any way whatsoever. So we're not quite at, do you think this A stands for France levels with this Captain America? But I don't know. I'm curious to see how he's different.
Yeah. And it's cool. That's the exploration. We're on.
We got another big issue to talk about on our big issue podcast, Batman 148 from DC Comics, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Jorge Jimenez. In this, is the final battle of Batman and Failsafe that's been taken over by the Batman of Zur-En-Arr. The big difference here, as we find out, is regular Batman, aka Bruce Wayne, has decided, you know what? I trust and respect my family, and I'm going to work with them and come up with a plan with them together rather than being my no Batman loner thing and move forward there. Justin, I'm curious to hear from you because I'm curious to hear from Justin specifically because, like, the thing that you've mentioned in almost every issue of Batman is you want to get back to the smiling Batman from the Batman animated series. In this issue, Batman smiles. Batman is like, I trust and respect my family. The problem was there was Zur and R in my head, and now that's out of my head, and now here I am again. I love you, son. So how did that feel?
I really enjoyed that. And shouts to Chip Zdarsky for being like, I'm going to make Batman fun through hard continuity choices. He literally is like, no. The reason I've been so mad is because I had this bad personality in my brain. I was like, wow, what a great excuse. I wish I could use that when I was younger for when I messed up situations. I hope that is followed through on by Chip or anyone else that is writing Batman going forward. I think Failsafe is just a great villain, and the teacher that Batman had that sort of incepted his brain. Great combination. We get the sort of Robin here as well. What a big Jason Todd week. We're going to talk a lot about Jason Todd, This was a cool Jason Todd story. And I want to shout out Tim's new look. Cool look from Tim.
Pete, what about you? What did you think about this book?
Yeah, some fun covers here. I love the twists and turns that this comic takes. I love the amazing art. Like you're saying, it's great to see Batman say, like, hey, I'll trust you. But the weird part is, by doing so, what he's saying is, like, I'll let you jump in front of this bullet and take this for me. Normally I would do this, but I'll let you die. But it's cool. I'll bring you back. It's kind of weird that that's how he's showing trust, but baby steps for Batman. And I agree with Justin. I hope that moving forward, we're going to see a more open Batman who leans on his family and talks to them and keeps them in the loop and doesn't all wish that they would just give him attention so they don't have to work so hard. You know what I mean?
What? Lean on his family. I love that. Everyone can aspire to leaning on our families more.
The thing that I thought was interesting about this issue is there's still so many things coming down the line for Batman at the same time. They end... spoiler here, but they end on this very hopeful note where they're like, the whole family is together, hooray! But also, as readers of comics, we know absolute power. The event is about to happen and wreak havoc on the whole universe. Vandal Savage is the commissioner of Gotham City.
Commissioner Savage.
That's pretty bad. And then beyond that, there's all just the regular things that are happening to Batman. Like, he hasn't dealt with the fact that he still has a weird robot hand or whatever is going on there. So... lots more stuff that's going to happen.
Also, it's weird that he was like, we're never going to die. I was like, that seems like you're jinxing it now. You know what I mean?
No.
He's got cave juice.
That was, to me, a very specific reference to the Grant Morrison run, which is what Chip Zdarsky has been riffing off of all the time. There was that very famous battle of Batman and Robin where they shout, Batman and Robin will never die. That was towards the beginning of the run. So he was putting it there and he was riffing off of that. At least that was my take.
What do you think about the Lazarus pit he's got in one of his bat caves? Because my question is, he's injecting that into everybody. Mm-hmm. How much bat shit is mixed in there? Because, like, there's a lot of bats in the cave. Is he
just because he's getting some from a cave doesn't mean there's guano in there. You know what I mean? Like, there's other things.
Assume the Lazarus pit juice is basically Mountain Dew. That's the color of it, right? So it looks like you drink Mountain Dew. When you drink Mountain Dew, how much bat shit is it?
It's a lot, right? There's a on the label it says how much legally it has to be below 15%, I think.
That's right. Real quick, do you like Mountain Dew Baja Blast better or Mountain Dew Batshit Blast?
Yeah. Guano's Revenge is my favorite Mountain Dew flavor.
That's the best Mountain Dew you can get.
That flavor's overrated, but I always get it at T-Bell. I don't know. Can we move on to another big issue?
Nope. You have to talk more about T-Bell. Anyone encountering Alex in the wild, be sure to ask him when his next trip to T-Bell for a chaloop is. You know,
I mean, the other day for my job, I ran 10 blocks to go eat two giant Cheez-It meals at Taco Bell, then ran 10 blocks back, and I felt so bad all day. It was awful. That sounds like a joke job.
That sounds like you got a pranked. Would you call them cheese meals?
Cheez-Its.
They did the new Cheez-It crossover.
16 times
like
the
size they did with burritos or Doritos, but now they got...
Sorry, guys. I guess my Taco Bell Google alerts didn't hit quite as hard as yours did.
You don't know what Taco Bell's doing at all times of the day?
We're so excited about comic books, and we talk about them all the time. We interrupt each other. You guys both are like champing at the bit to get out. Like, actually, it's Taco Bell's cheese. You got the big cheeses. I was like, okay. Wait a second.
This podcast, for a very long time, has only been a vehicle so I could talk about Cheez-Its, and we're finally there. Yes. Scarlet, number one from Image Comics and Scarlet, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Marco Ferrari. Depending on when you're listening to this, later on today or already, we have an interview with Kelly Thompson and Marco Ferrari talking very specifically about this issue with spoilers. So go listen to that in the Comic Book Club feed, but forgetting about them and what we told them about liking the book. Pete, let's be honest here. What'd you think?
This is a fucking unbelievable book. I almost feel like in our interview, we undersold it trying to be cool because... This is just, I mean, glorious.
I got a spoiler for you. You did not undersell it.
Okay, good. Love the art style. I just love how badass it is. Also, the fact that it started with no words. You know what I mean? All action, leaning into the art. Great
entry
point.
Very James Bond.
Very fantastic way to kind of get into this book. I was like, holy shit, it's Jinx. And and the Storm Shadow reveal at the end, spoilers, but I geeked out. I totally lost it. I was like, holy shit.
Now, and she's called Jinx because her power is that she owes you a Coke. Is that correct, Pete?
Good.
It's like Domino kind of powers, you know what I mean?
Oh, nice. Okay. Pete, when you say Storm Shadow, is that like a shadow cast by a storm? Is that like
a cloud? Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow, bro. Okay,
so he's like
the
a cloud ninja.
Ninjas that are.
Can I bring up one thing that we talked about in the interview? Because Justin, I feel like you'll appreciate this.
I have a lot of questions.
Yes, so we get to see Snowjob. During
I have so many questions.
Yeah, there's a flashback where he's drinking tropical drinks, and I brought it up to Kelly Thompson because I was like, that seems like the opposite of a snow job. That's a tropical job. That's a hot weather job. And she was like, no, we're... She justified it, but I don't think it's justified, to be honest.
I think it is.
I think it ruins the entire comic.
I think it's a fun joke to make where Snow Job is in some places tropical having a tropical drink.
How did he get hired for that?
There's many levels to Snow Job. He's not just one dimensional.
There's one level, and it's he gets hired for Snow Jobs.
The idea of saying there's many levels to Snow Job, let's put a pin in that for the future. But let me also say, how many other weather Joes do we have to look forward to? And do they, like, we have Snow Job, we have Storm Ninja. Like, is there, like, just like a breezy Saturday? Are we going to get to meet Breezy Saturday? Because I look forward to
that. Casual Fridays. Is there Port Sitter?
Yeah, there isn't Port Sitter.
What other weathers are there? Weather
is there a bingo night? Is there a bingo night?
That'd be fun. Bingo night. More of the elderly.
I mean,
Joes.
Shipwreck is maybe. I don't know. I don't know if that's like a
shipwreck. What's his skill? Nice. Wrecking ships?
Yeah, he's like a Launchpad McQuack of the G.I. Joe universe. Shipwreck's bad luck. I would not want him out there.
Oh, we got a sale there. Should we get Shipwreck? Absolutely.
No.
Yeah.
No. The Shipwreck. No, sorry. We have Loud Asshole here. Why'd you hire him? Pick your Joes carefully.
Yeah.
Enough. No more ninjas. There's too many ninjas.
I thought this was really good. Marco Ferrari's art is great throughout here. Oh, there's a double page spread towards the end of the book where Scarlett is fighting.
Fight sequences.
Very cool. And, you know, this is Kelly Thompson. She knows her way around spy stuff at this point from Black Widow and other
things. She's also a fan of G.I. Joe, it seemed like. She knew her stuff.
Yes, that's fine. We don't need to geek card Kelly Thompson of all people. But she gives it enough flavor that Scarlett is different from Black Widow, is different from the characters that she's writing in Birds of Prey. The relationship with Scarlett and Jinx is interesting. Yeah. It's another winner from the Energon universe that just does not stop winning at this point.
Yeah, it's and this is specific, interesting, really well done from our artistic point of view. It's very good.
Plus, you get to see her with a crossbow. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Scarlet.
Yeah, that was the main thing I took away too.
Great bow job she does. That's better. I mean, it's a better name for her. Yeah. Bow job.
Yeah. You guys ever get a bow job?
Let's move on to the blood hunt.
The blood hunt has begun.
Let's get into the blood hunt.
Blood Hunters number
what
two,
a blood from pack.
Written by Kare Andrews, Ed Nesente, and Erica Schultz. Art by Alex Linz, David Baldion, and Bernard Cheng. This title, and we're going to talk about an additional Blood Hunt title in a second, but this title is the anthology title showing what's happening with other characters throughout the Blood Hunt. What'd you guys think about this one?
We got three fun stories here.
Yeah.
First one was sort of a confusing Hulk story where I was like, how old is this Bruce Banner? Very strange, age, a Hawkeye story that I thought was fantastic. My standout of the three of them was that one. And then we get a nice, Elsa Bloodstone being like, yeah. Wait, our vampire butler is nice. Why is he so mad suddenly? I thought that was cool. And I like that one felt the most sort of on brand for the Blood Hunt because it was like had a horror energy. Like it was cool. I like this book. I like having this book, getting little bites from the Blood Hunt happening all around.
Yeah, I agree. This is fun. It's nice to spend time in the hunt, seeing what's going down. And, you know, those creepy ghost twins, were just,
great stuff.
Ridiculous. It was good to see Dagger, you know?
Troubling Dagger.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing is that last story, I believe, is setting up a Blood Hunters series that's going to pick up after this. So we are going to see that team and
more
it's a cool
hunting
team.
For blood.
It's fun. Dagger, Elsa Bloodstone, White Widow. Was there somebody else?
Frankenstein's hanging around?
Yeah, for sure. Frankenstein. Why not?
Hey,
I always love when Frankenstein shows up in a comic book because I'm like, huh, all right, what's his continuity? That's just like you threw Frankenstein in there. Why not?
Well, the Frankenstein in both the Marvel and DC universes are like wild takes on the character. There's so much. I guess you're not going to be like a lurching but emotional character from the book, but... So
it's just
swing.
Weird when like the public domain characters show in, and I don't know why I didn't have a problem with Dracula showing up earlier in Blood Hunt and Frankenstein, but I don't know, whatever.
It's well, yeah, you want Mickey Mouse
I do.
Recently entering the public domain.
Oh, that'd be great. And if they could bring in Superman in a couple of years, that would be fun too. Wolverine Blood Hunt number one from Marvel, written by, once again, Tom Waltz, art by Juan Jose Rip. In this issue, you're not going to believe this. Wolverine is a bar just trying to mind his business when suddenly he gets interrupted by some people that attack him. Legitimately, this is a story I have never seen before in my life, and I was just bowled over. Like, why has nobody ever done that before, Pete?
Yeah, it's like when Charles Xavier sits down with a chat with Magneto. You know, people love to see it. It's a go-to.
Okay, if you want to get back to that, that is something that has not happened for years at this point because Magneto has been dead. They've been in the Quiet Council.
Oh, yeah? You haven't been watching the animated series that's been going on, X-Men 97?
That was a well-deserved conversation in the comics.
It sure was.
I don't care about TV because the only artistic medium I care about is comic books.
Okay. This is a well-deserved conversation between the two. Our Professor X and Magneto just battling philosophically.
Once again. Classic chess match of the mind.
Yes. Who? Oh, checkmate. Pete.
It's okay when it happens in a book that I like, but if Wolverine does it, I don't like it.
Quit your chess job.
Let me ask you this. Why is Wolverine such a mug guy? Every time you see him in a bar, he's drinking out of a mug. He doesn't drink out of a cocktail.
Just once, I would love to see him drinking out of one of those yard things that are like shoes.
Oh, so exactly. Hard to drink out of one of those yardsticks.
I want the, because this is a fun classic Wolverine tear him up situation.
Right.
But I want Wolverine to be having like, you know what, let me spring for an espresso martini. I'm just cutting loose tonight. Him just like sipping.
I don't think he drinks that, man.
I want to see it. Like,
green apple martini?
When you're out of different, you're feeling different? Because what I'm saying is like the parts of this that I didn't like was Wolverine, this is like paint by number a little bit, Wolverine, and I'm ready to shake it up. I want Wolverine to sit down and be like, I'm feeling spicy tonight. I want a margarita with a tahini rim, and I want to, I'm going to snicked, and I'm going to bub around with my friends, and I'll kill some people when I need to. That's a Wolverine story.
I mean... You're getting all of that except for the different drink choices. The only thing you're not getting here. So I don't know why you're.
He's not bubbing around. I guess he's bubbing around with this friend.
Yeah, he is.
He gets a phone call. He gets so many phone calls in this where he's always like, "Hello, Wolverine. You have Wolverine. You're a gopher Wolverine."
Both of and these
he's
books.
Like, he's like Maverick. Maverick calling is like, "Hey man, what's up? Remember we were
I did
in,
like spoiler here. Spoiler alert. Though whatever, we haven't given a spoiler early in the podcast. I did like Maverick being a vampire for no inexplicable reason. He's just a character who shows up. He's like, "Hey man, I got a half mask on my face. It looks like fangs. So now I got real fangs. Let's go." And both of these books to me, and I don't say this derogatorily, but both of these books to me felt like. They had a big whiteboard up with all of the characters. Like, throw out a character who has a relationship with a vampire in the Marvel Universe already. Great. You've got a story. You got a one shot. You got a two shot. Let's go. And that's what this is here, because it's like, is that Captain Britain? She's basically wearing Captain Britain costume, but she's a vampire. I don't know who she is. It doesn't matter. She is a vampire that knows Wolverine. And would just kind of roll from there.
Yeah, Night Guard. That's what you put in if you grit your teeth. And so I love to see that brought to life in one of my favorite comics.
Shout out to the people who wear Night Guards.
I wish I had more of a relationship. Yes, definitely. Shout out. While we're shouting people out, shout out to the people. My fam out there putting the Night Guard in night after night, keeping their molars off their downstairs molars.
Let's come out.
I just want more of a relationship between these characters. It doesn't have to be sexual or romantic, but like, give me something here. Wolverine bumps into her, and I was like, how do you know each other? And he's like, hey, what's up?
Wolverine's like, check the box at the bottom of the paddle, bub.
He's bubbing. He's bubbing out
that
there.
That said, Juan Jose Rip art. Always love that. Yes. Always a fan of seeing that. Let's move on and talk about My Adventures with Superman, number one from DC Comics, written by Josie Campbell, art by Pablo M. Collar. This takes place between season one and season two of My Adventure with Superman, and I believe it is based on a script they didn't use for the show. This is in continuity. This is following up. If you haven't watched the show, it's picking up with a Superman and Lois Lane and Jimmy, who now are no longer interns. They have been hired by the Daily Planet, but they're still basically cub reporters and figuring stuff out. Also, this is a Superman who is more conflicted and younger and doesn't quite know how to use his powers yet. I thought this was great. Josie Campbell, she is a co-producer on the show, so of course she knows her way around here. I think Pablo M. Collar's art is decidedly different, but does a nice job channeling the TV show as well. As a fan of the TV show, I was happy to read this as well. What did you guys think?
Did you say cub reporter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a thing?
Yeah, it's like when you're a reporter and you sit on the floor and like you have a little jar of honey and you kind of like scoop the honey into your mouth.
Don't you think that's inappropriate not to be wearing pants in a work setting?
No, you're allowed to if you're a Cub reporter. That's what you're hired to do is you can not wear pants, eat honey.
You can go through people's garbage if you want. It's cool.
Wow, that's awesome. That's
a great way to get scoops. And you got to follow the mama bear, who is your manager.
That's how Maggie Haberman got on the Trump beat, as she was going through the garbage, found some big clues.
Oh, my God. Anyways.
Yeah, I thought this, that honey, that sweet honey.
I thought this was, like, it did such a great job of honoring the animation style that the cartoon is based
this
on.
This should be a cartoon.
Yeah, it really looks like it was pulled right from it and kind of put in still form here, which is great.
By the way, did you hear the way this was an interesting news story I read about Maggie Haberman got stuck in the door of the White House once when she had eaten too much honey? And
oh, man, that's a problem.
She had to wait several seasons to get thin enough for Rabbit to pull her out.
Yeah, and then Nate Cohn was like, oh, stuck in the door again, Maggie.
But I thought this, story was nice, you know, the kind of, Superman maybe learning kind of what's right and what wrong. So I thought it was a good story to do.
Oh, bother. I ate 538 jars of honey.
I agree. This is fun. I like where it ends up with the parasite stuff at the end. It seems fun.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Definitely watch the show. It's great. Second season is great as well. Profane, number one for Boob Studios, written by Peter Milligan, art by Raul Fernandez. This is a wild swing of a tale about a detective who, it's not entirely clear, but I'm going to say slowly starts to realize that maybe he's fictional by the end of the book. That's not so much a spoiler. I think you can kind of figure that out from the synopsis and premise that they threw out there. But that's where we end up as we go along. I was really intrigued by this. This is Peter Milligan's a very different writer from Mike Carey, but this reminded me a little bit of was it Unwritten back in the day? Where it was also them being like, hold on, are we in a story here? What's going on? So same sort of vibes there. Good stuff. Great art from Raul Fernandez. I'm definitely on board for issue two.
Yeah.
That's amazing. A great call. Great call to reference sort of the Fables verse, because it has that energy. Just instead of it being fairy tales, it's noir and detective stories, which is cool. This also reminds me of what was that Matt Kent book from a couple months ago?
I know what you're talking about.
Where it's a detective sort of realizing that he's fictional and slipping through genres and not really sort of becoming unstuck in his own personal story, which was very cool.
Yeah. Why Zellotron's looking that up. I thought that this was love the art, love the twists and turns that this kind of murder mystery takes. And I trust the team on this, so I'm very excited to see what happens next.
Subgenre. It's the name of the book. But yes, good call on that. Good stuff. Let's talk about an advance review, Self-Help, number
one.
Don't
spoil it, Justin.
From Image Comics, written by Owen King and Jesse Kellerman, art by Mariana Ignazzi. This is about a guy who is a down on his luck, not exactly an Uber driver, but he's working for a rideshare thing. He looks exactly like an incredibly successful self-help guru. You could probably figure this out, but it's not exactly the Prince of the Pauper riff.
Oh, I thought you were going to say princess switch.
Yeah, sure. I would definitely not say that.
That's funny. Two great references, one from very different generations.
Yes, exactly. Pete's much younger than I am. He's a cool teen, and I'm an older guy who grew up when Prince of the Pauper was a thing. Anyway, it's not exactly that. It's not exactly what you expect. It's much darker than that. Owen King, if you can't tell from the last name King, things tend to go a little darker. But really good stuff. Very reminiscent of Mariana Ignazzi's art, and almost the tone is very reminiscent of a Chip Zdarsky book, I felt like. I was very into this as well. Good noir set in Los Angeles.
Very cool. There's a great sort of homage to the movie Vertigo in the front of it. And I thought that was a very Hitchcockian, sort of a modernized Hitchcock tale, which I thought was really cool. Definitely something I want to read more of.
Yeah, and just because a person has the last name King doesn't mean they have to always, you know, do things a certain way. You know what I mean? Like, well, let's not try to put them all in one box. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The I kings mean, don't compete. All just go here. You know what
your
I mean?
Last name is defining. Your name is LePage, and you host a comic book podcast. It's
right. Like, oh, my God. Right. Say it like that.
He is the son of Stephen King, so.
Oh.
Got him.
So there's that as well. I mean, that's
That makes a lot of sense why you would say that then.
What's the name?
Yes, that is in fact why I said that. The Amazing Spider-Man number 51 from Marvel, written by Zeb Wells, art by Ed McGuinness, and Todd Knock. If you didn't read the last issue, Spider-Man is now a goblin, and also Norman Osborn is a goblin. It's goblins all the way down, and Spider-Man has been hit with the spear, which has filled him with Norman Osborn's sins, but are the sins
in
him?
Alex, we all know about the spear that fills you with sins. If you get hit by the sins, Kraven's upset because of the sin spear.
Kraven has the sin spear, but the sin spear is broken.
If it's already been sinned?
Right. Well, if you don't have the sins, you can't use the sins.
Yeah.
You got to reload the sin spear with different sins.
Yeah, you got to reload the sin spear. Otherwise, it won't work.
Also, very important to mention, the living braid is now a walking braid, and the walking braid is walking with the lizard, who is not a lizard, and they're looking to find somebody, and that somebody is J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah, which he's very excited about.
I just imagine a kid who loves the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies picking up this book and being like,
what?
Walking computer brain? Finds the my favorite character, the news guy? Cool. I'm on board.
Spider-Man's a goblin? Great. How does his tongue work in that costume? I don't understand.
That was a definite question in my head.
The art is amazing, though. Tongue jokes aside, Ed McGuinness, it's always great to see his art on stuff. So at least there's that kind of fun that I can have with it.
Let me say this. Do you think that, like when Pinocchio tells a lie, when you have more sins in you, your tongue gets longer?
Absolutely.
Ooh.
Mm. Something to think about.
Whoa.
Think about, wow, that's a sin tongue. Alex got a sin tongue. Alex got a sin tongue, and I think we know that. Who's got a big tongue? Jabba the Hutt. Big sin guy. Big sin guy. Venom. This whole thing is sins.
I wish this Amazing Spider-Man title was about Spider-Man.
Well, let me say, while we're talking about that, so in this, Spider-Man is goblined up. He's gone crazy, like Green Goblin. He has a costume that is sort of vaguely Spider-Man, but mostly Green Goblin. He goes after the Sinister Six. He goes after the Sinister Six to kill them. And he flies in looking like Green Goblin. And they're all like, oh, no, Spider-Man. And I was like, get out of here.
Yeah, There's no way
you know that. This guy's all goblin. So I thought that was a funny.
They were like, oh, no, Spider-Man. He's been infected by the sins of Norman Osborn, which are normally resident in that spear sin, sin spear, excuse me, that is held by Kraven the Hunter. But that's broken.
The idea that could, I mean, the art is great in this. The idea that our sort of the people we have to rely on here are Chasm, living brain robot, and then Kraven's watching Spider-Man like basically kill everyone. And he's like, Spider-Man, come on.
What a great entrance by Chasm. I think it's always best when you get to like that big kind of panel and they just says their name all creepy. Like, come on, that's fun.
I do like this use of Chasm, a character that I don't like. So there's that.
Why is Kraven concerned about Spider-Man being Spider-Man?
Well,
how does he not know how his spear works?
Well, he is also, this is probably important to mention, I believe, the son of Kraven, who has the memories of Kraven, because he's a clone of Kraven or something like that.
That's who that is.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
That's why he's young.
I don't know about you guys. How the spear works?
I love comics.
I also love comics. And I also, and honestly, like, I like the core idea here that I just want to, the interesting part is not Peter Parker basically kill, like, knocking the octopus juice out of Doc Ock.
Oh, man.
Like, the interesting part is, like, what is going on in Spider-Man's brain while he has these sins in him? Like, that's the, so,
well,
like, I want to get to
that. A consistent problem with Zeb Wells' run that occasionally he writes, and we're like, oh, this is a really good issue of Spider-Man, but it's few and far between because most of the time Spider-Man is shunted to the side for literally everybody else. And it's, I don't know, it's frustrating. Let's move on then and talk about DC Pride, A Celebration of Rachel Pollack, number one from DC Comics, written by Rachel Pollack and Joe Carallo, art by Scott Eaton, Michael Allred, and Rye Hickman. This is, per the name, a tribute to the late, great Rachel Pollack, specifically focusing on her character Coagula that she created for Doom Patrol. We're getting some reprints of old issues that she wrote involving the character, who was, I believe, maybe I have this detail wrong, but the first openly trans superhero character, at least in DC Comics, if not in comics or mainstream comics. And then we're also getting this backup story, which is a new story paying tribute to the character by Rachel Pollack's friend Joe Carallo and art by Rye Hickman. This is a massive collection. This is about over 100 pages long. But I want to say just up front, having nothing to do with the content, I love that DC did this for Pride Month. I think that's laudable. That's great. And beyond the fact that it is a fun comic with some wild ideas in it,
I just appreciate
the fact that they did this.
Agree. It's like, for all of those reasons you just said, and it's such a nice, the Vertigo at the time when these comics came out, which was like mid-90s, I think, because we get a reprint of The Geek as well. Like, it was just a wilder place with, like, people making interesting choices, and the art is such a way that we don't really see anymore. Like, we get this, the villain here is named Codpiece.
Yeah,
it's really
evil
funny.
Codpiece.
He's got a, which is coming right out of the old crotch in a fun way. The backstory there is interesting. Like, that, there's just so many ideas at play here, and it was just such a, so refreshing to read this from a creator that, like, was just ahead of the, ahead of their time in a great way.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable art. I love the 90s feel to it. It's very cool stories, very creative and fun, and I think this is a great celebration of something cool.
Beyond the Pale, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Christopher Umgard, art by Tomas Ara. This is a new book from Dark Horse, and I'm excited to hear what you guys thought about.
Yeah,
what?
I mean, this is a badass start with the welcome to the suck, leave your soul at the door. What a fun kind of opening way to start it. I thought it did a good job of getting you kind of hyped for how insane things are going to get.
That's on the cover. You're saying?
Yeah, right.
This is a...
Justin, over to you.
A lot of great information from our two philosophical... Our Magneto and Professor X really dropping some huge points. Thank you guys for your pithy understanding.
Well, when Pete and I play chess, it's like, pawn, pawn... Pawn. Oh, we're done.
It's just a stack of pawns meeting in the center of the board and being like, good days, tip of my hat to you. We've tied yet again.
So also we get this kind of like two things going on here. We got this like crazy over the top war story going on. And then we have this fun idea that also there are monsters there. It's not just a horrible Vietnam story that we've heard before.
Where did this Vietnam conflict happen?
There's also monsters.
We're following the photographer who's going into Vietnam and like is able to make a lot of sort of big choices for the soldiers she's around and dealing with consequences that spring out of that. There's a lot of stuff happens in this, and it's hard to tell. By the end of it, we realize that, yes, there's some sort of monster that feels like it's going to be symbolic of something. It's just we don't know what it is yet. But it is
a symbol of a monster.
Yeah, I will, in full disclosure, I completely forgot what this book was when we were talking about it, in case that wasn't clear. But now that you're mentioning the plot, yes, I really like this a lot. This felt to me, I know we're going to be talking about Get Fury in a couple of seconds, but this feels like a Garth Ennis war book for most of the run. I think it shadows that really nicely as this photographer is not photographer, journalist is investigating what's going on with this troop, the Vietnam War. But I loved like the just almost casual reveal of, oh yeah, there's a Lovecraftian monster flying around and eating people. Where I was like, what? That was not what I was expecting for this book at all. And that definitely drew me in. I know I've talked a lot about how Image Comics in particular has this thing where like, they're like, the entire issue, we're laying in the characters, and then here's the sci-fi fantasy twist at the end. This did not feel like this. That felt like, instead, almost like a Predator movie or an Alien movie, where it's just, hey, we're just kind of here and we're experiencing these things. But ultimately, there's this metaphor in terms of whatever this creature is going to enter and really mess things up. I'm excited to read the second issue because I feel like they're going to delve more into that metaphor, that creature, whatever is going on there. That's pretty cool.
Agree. And, you know, it's funny. We were just talking about Vertigo. This feels a little bit like a 90s Vertigo book in a cool way. So funny to have mentioned that.
The Infernals, number 4 from Image Comics, written by Dylan Gardner and Ryan Barrett. Art by John J. Pearson and Lola Bonato. We have been following what we kind of called Succession Goes to Hell, I believe, with the first issue.
Yes. You're a big Ryan Parrott guy, Alex.
I am. I'm a parrot head. That's the only time that's used, right, I believe?
Yeah, technically, yes.
Yeah, for Ryan Parrott. Anyway, we are following three kids who have been vying for their father's empire. There's been some twists, turns. In this issue, some big stuff goes down involving our characters, leading to, I presume, a final battle. I really like this book in terms of how they're diving into a specific character each issue and showing them in a different light than we'd expect. Like, you'd expect them to be the most messed up, evil people possible. That's not what we're getting here. They have their own wants and needs. But also, the art is great. Like, continuing on the Vertigo bed, it feels very Lucifer, Constantine, back in the day, very Vertigo there terms of the team. Really good stuff, really funny and dark at the same time. So I like this book quite a bit.
Lucifer is a great comp for this because it's definitely what it feels like. And like Lucifer, sometimes reading that comic, I was like, what exactly is happening? Things happen quickly. Like in this, we come upon an infernal wedding. Yeah, infernal marriage. I was like, why are they getting married? And then it's like, oh, it's not a good thing that they just did that. It was very, and it just, everything's happening very fast. And it feels like it's like showing up at a party where you don't quite know everyone. And so you have to sort of catch up as you're reading it.
But what's nice is I do like the pace and the action. You know what I mean? Like, they are kind of like churning through this. And I think it's in an interesting way that kind of keeps things kind of going, which I really appreciate. Yeah, it's insane, but it's also very enjoyable. So I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah. Next up, Get Furry, something Pete did a lot in his recent past.
No, don't you. Come on, man. This is Garth Ennis. Put some respect on it.
Oh, he wouldn't care about that. Get Fury, number 2 from Marvel, written by Garth Ennis, art by Jason Burroughs. In this issue, Frank Castle is trying to track down Nick Fury, who has been captured by, maybe I got this wrong, but I believe the Viet Cong, and is being trucked through the jungle and forced to face the most disgusting indignities that Garth Ennis can think about in his twisted brain. Meanwhile, Frank Castle is doing some very light spy work that goes extremely poorly, as you could probably expect. And back on the home front, laudably so, Garth Ennis is doing his usual edgy but also woke stuff. And I say that positively because I feel like he has this – there's a scene in here where there's like a old school mustached general – who's railing against the fact that they know that there are homosexuals in the army, and everybody's just like, who cares? There are bigger things to deal with. And that to me feels like a very classic Garth Ennis thing where he's like, I'm getting the joke, and then I'm also contrasting the joke in a very thought-forward way at the same time.
That's great. Agree. This, I think this is fantastic. I love this. Yes. I love how Garth Ennis and like big extreme choices are happening all the time. The art's fantastic. the idea that these some spoilers here, the corruption of them like hiding drugs in like soldiers, American soldiers' corpses as they are being sent back home is great story point, super fucked up. And then the end of the issue, I'll just say, is to me, I was reading this, I was like smiling because it's the most Garth Ennis thing. Fury is like, they're mad because the Americans like killed slash hurt a bunch of civilians. So the people who are holding him hostage are punching him and suddenly slam his face into a corpse. And then the next panel is Fury's face comes out and the guy wakes up and is like, what? I'm dying here. I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What the fuck is this? It's such a great. Like, I'm not making fun of it. It was just like such a Garth Ennis extra step that we didn't know we needed until the guy's like, what are you doing in my intestines?
He just gets his face rubbed in someone else's intestines as they're dying. It's messed up. I just is so happy to have this book. It's so nice that, like, I don't know. There's something about having a Garth Ennis kind of Max kind of label book on the shelves. It just feels nice to kind of – I think he does such a great job writing these war stories, these fucked up things, whether it's with Frank Castle or Fury or both of them. I just think that, is – a wheelhouse that feels right. And the combination of art and storytelling here is just glorious in the kind of best ways.
Birds of Prey, number 10 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Gavin Grigri and Robbie Rodriguez. The Birds of Prey are searching for Barbara Gordon, who, well, we find out this issue, but has been targeted for death for some reason that we don't know. And they are, in this issue, trapped in a suburban nightmare of Barda's creation. I continue to love the series. I think the art is great. Robbie Rodriguez, nothing against Gavin Grigri, but Robbie Rodriguez in particular is such a great addition to this book. Kelly Thompson writes the heck out of it.
Yeah, this is just kind of fun. And then we have, a little bit of twists and turns of who's on whose side here. But, love the kind of tripped out nature of this. This continues to be very creative and unique in cool ways. I think that what they're doing on Birds of Prey is really impressive artistically.
The art is so good in this book. It's so different, interesting, really like carving out its own space. And reading this arc specifically, this is the second issue of the arc, feels like when I first watched Doctor Who when I was a kid, and I was like, what the fuck is this? This is a little scary, but it's like normal people doing stuff, like just lost in a weird world. The great, just like one page of Barbara Gordon, but like just nailing the character so hard. It's just really good.
Love Everlasting, number 15 from Image Comics, written by Tom King, art by Elsa Charettier. This is a big issue if you've been following this comic all along, as our cowboy, who's been tracking down Joan and killing her, kidnaps her and basically lays out maybe not the whole mythology, but a lot of the mythology of what's been going on here in the background. Yeah. And ultimately, big spoiler here, but Joan encounters her mom and finds out why her mom has been doing this, or at least her mom says why she was doing this, whether it's true or not. Big surprising. I don't know what it means for the series going forward, but good as usual.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, first off, the art's unbelievable. It's the real hero of this, and I love it so very much. But yeah, we get a lot of information, and it's, issue 15, which is very interesting. I feel like it hasn't been frustrating not knowing a lot of this stuff, but it's nice to kind of get this out here a little bit. Just so creative, this book. It's such unique storytelling. This continues to just be a banger.
I mean, it's crazy to have this mystery that continues on, and the story is being very coy about what's actually happening. And even as we get more and more information, there's still more to be uncovered. And that's normally that's a criticism, but it actually really works here. And I'm starting to think that Joan isn't just like this character or it's a story about stories. I think Joan is the concept of romance comics. She Ooh. Is the that's her who she is.
She is the
so
romance.
It's much more of an embodiment than sort of like a metaphor or something. And I think that's an even more interesting version of this story. If it's mm-hmm. like, yes, romance comics are cyclical. They're telling similar stories all the time, but there is a reason for them. There's an underlying truth to them, and that's why they're still popular. And to have one that is dissecting that like this in an interesting way is really cool. And I just love continuing to explore this idea.
Cult of the Lamb, number one from Odie Press, written by Alex Pachtendahl, art by Troy Little. If you haven't listened to our live show where we talked about Cult of the Lamb with Alex, that's all I had to say.
Do it.
Ah, well, it's weird that you would go out of your way for that kind of sentence. But anyways, yeah, this is just, I mean, the art is such a fun choice. The cuteness mixed with violence in this adorable way is just
Pete formula. That's a Pete win.
Yeah, that's a W in my book. I mean, this is just. It kind of reminds me of Gravity Falls a little bit.
The I was going to. That was what I was going to say. My kids are watching that, and yeah, the art is very Gravity Falls in some of the sort of characters. And Gravity Falls, just rewatching it with them or hearing them watch it for the first time, is so fucking good.
Great it is show. Great. Yeah, I love Gravity Falls.
Sorry, I interrupted you, Pete, out of excitement and joy.
No, it's all right. I mean, that's basically I just am really enjoying this book, and the style of it is really fun.
I thought this was going to be a comic that you picked for the week, Pete, because to me it's Gravity Falls meets Samurai Jack, two things that I know you like. So I thought it was very cool.
Yeah, agreed.
Miss Marvel, Mutant Menace, number four from Marvel, written by Sabir Persada and Aman Vellani, art by Scott Godlewski. We are following Kamala Khan, who has been taken in by the Inhumans because her powers are out of control. Turns out her mutant side and Inhuman side are kind of at war here. Spoiler, but they fix it, and she kind of moves on to the next thing. We also get what I think everybody expected, which is Kamala versus the evil dead body of herself.
Yeah.
But the big revelation here, the big spoiler here, is her mutant power is also exactly what everybody thought it was, which is hard light powers out of the TV show. So we get a lot of establishment here, a lot of setup, even though this team is teeing it up for NYX, which is where Miss Marvel is headed next in terms of titles. What did you think about the final issue here? And also, this is probably the final issue this team is working on.
Oh, man.
That as well.
Well, that's sad. I mean, this is great. This is another great issue. Really, just you can tell that they're having fun here. You know, it really jumps out of the page. The artwork's unbelievable. The storytelling has real heart to it. Kamala hanging out with Lockjaw and just treating like a giant puppy is hysterical. The sweet moment we got with Bruno was nice. You know, I just think that there's a lot of great comics that are going they're going on here. So yeah, I'm having a blast with it.
I last issue I was sort of lightly criticizing the idea that we are doing everything all at once with this comic by having her then have to do all the Inhuman stuff. But I actually thought this issue really nailed it. I thought it was great to have her go through the Terrigen Mist and like all of that. I thought that was really interesting and cool. The only thing is that I think is from an editorial point of view, it's funny that they put her through Terrigen Mist, so she keeps her Inhuman powers, which is like stretching and stuff.
Right, right.
But she's getting the mutant powers, which is like stretching light to make like hands and stuff from the Marvel show. It's like now she could do both in a weird mm-hmm. way. And I don't know what that means. I felt like it would have been very easy to line up the comic with the TV show and be like, oh, sorry, you can't be Terrigen Mist is bad for mutants, which is something that's been established in comic book continuity before. You can't go through that. You have to give up your stretchy powers. You just have the hard light. I think that would have been a very sort of like graceful move to line up the character in both mediums. But they didn't do that. So, like, and shouts to them for being like, nah, we're just going to keep going, keep it going. And the, maybe the hard light powers will manifest in a different way.
I like her stretchy powers.
I could be totally off base about this, but that to me feels like editorial discussing, hey, people love this and they love her comic book origin. Like people were, Pete was saying, they love the fact that she can stretch. We got to keep that in some fashion because the ultimate setup of we're going to turn her into a mutant so that she has powers to match up with what she has on TV and on the big screen. That's what you want to do. And, you know, more conspiracy minded would be like, the Marvel's movie failed at the box office, so they're not going to do it. But I don't think that enters into the conversation as much as like, hey, man, let's change it so these things match up. So I don't know where that nets out, but I feel like it's a confusing conversation that you have at an editorial retreat that nets out into the comic book that we saw here. But I still liked it. Like, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this issue. I thought it was great. And looking forward to how they sort of align all of that stuff in the NYX book.
For sure. The Boy Wonder, number 2 from DC Comics by Judy Ba Pete. This is one of your big issues of the week as Damian Wayne bonds with Jason Todd, who's...
Big Todd really, week.
Really been scratching his skin a lot in this issue.
Oh, my God. Just like you, you scratch your head a lot. Amazing cover. Worth it for the art alone. This comic is just so great. I love the artistic stone, the tone that it has, the story with two Robins fighting and then talking it out. I love it. I love to see it. It makes me happy. The art makes me happy as well. This is just a total package.
I like the exploration here of the Robins sort of coming together. Robin. We get to see Robin. The different things that they their lives. There's a nice tone to this too. It feels like a little creepy. Like it reminded me a little bit of like Adventure Time. Some of the episodes where they get into larger subjects and the sort of art style being a bit in that same animated world. This is a great creative swing of a book.
Yes.
I agree. Judy Ba's art is phenomenal in here. I love how he's focusing on a different Robin every single issue. This is really, really smartly done. And like I said with the last issue, I appreciate the fact that this is a Black Label book that is not like adults only. It's instead really digging into the Robins in a way that is dark, is interesting, but it feels like this dark fairy tale. It's very nicely done.
Yeah. So you're saying it's like adults only. It's not adults only. It's like adults only.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, and like older teens. Bear Pirate Viking Queen, number 2 from Image Comics, written by Sean Lewis, art by Jonathan Marks Baravecchia.
Come on.
We're getting a bear. We're getting a pirate. We're getting a Viking. We're getting a queen. They're giving it all to you. It's all coming together.
Guys, you have to choose one. What do you choose? Bear Pirate Viking Queen. Bear.
Fuck, marry, kill.
Come nice. Bear.
Fuck, marry, kill, work with.
Ah, nice. Wow. That should be what the game is always.
Fuck, marry, kill, coworker.
Yeah.
Fuck the bear.
Oh my god.
Yeah, this is a pirate.
Fuck Donatello. Marry Mikey. Oh my god. Co-work with Leonardo, he leads. And then whatever the other one is the other
Donatello, one. You fuck it. All right, listen. Yeah, this is amazing.
I don't know what his name is.
I love
I'm fucking Donatello. He does machines, and I want him to make me his machine.
Oh my god! amazing creepy art in this. This is super
fucking machine.
Super tight bananas artwork. Great story. Great action.
I love fucking a turtle.
Love all the madness. Fast paced. A lot of happens. You know, a Viking comes home. You know what I mean? And you know, sometimes you bring a bear with you.
So you're gonna take the shell off, or how does this work? Do I get in the shell?
I mean, here's the thing. Turtles have crazy penises. I don't want to get into it too much here because that's not what this podcast is about. But they really
sure
do.
Isn't. Justin,
I think we've covered a lot of it. We're knocking on the door of describing a turtle penis.
I will mention, I've actually forgotten. Like, I've forgotten what the deal is with turtle penises, but I do remember when I was working at MTV, we were talking about the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie where they had, like, super realistic turtles. It was the Michael Bay one. And one of my writers was like, so they have penises or what's going on? I was like, well, now you have to call a turtle expert and talk to them about it. And she did. And it was great. It was a great article. Case Wickman. Check it out. Google Case Wickman, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles penis, MTV News, and you'll find a great article.
Right. And make sure you clear your history before you go. Don't do it on your work computer.
Justin, would you give this comic a 10 out of 10?
This is wow. Look at Pete trying to subtly move on from this turtle.
10 inches out of 10 inches? Is that what you're saying?
10 inches? Wow, I gotta read this article. This book is fun. I like that we finally got to the queen.
Yeah.
In this mm-hmm. issue.
I was wondering about that. I was like, did I misinterpret it? The bear is a queen, or the pirate is a queen, or the Viking is a queen? But it's not. There's a queen.
No. And this queen looks nasty, dude.
Oh, man. Like, she looks great mad. Depiction of it. Just so fun.
This
so
is a gorgeous
great.
Book. Like we talked about with the last issue, there's a little more dialogue from Sean Lewis here, but it is mostly standing back and letting Jonathan do the art. To that point, I'll give a little plug. Jonathan Marks Barravecchia is going to be doing an exhibit of his art at, I believe it's the Philippe Dumont Gallery in New York on June 6th and 7th. So if you want to check it out in person, go check it out there because it's gorgeous. Soon. Like, it's awesome.
It's this weekend.
It's this weekend. It's not even Pete, this weekend. Up, it's Thursday
Pete, what
Friday.
Galleries are you hitting this weekend?
Oh,
would you
man.
Like to hit the
so
Dumont?
So many. I would love to.
Oh boy. Minor Threats, The Fastest Way Down, number 3 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Patton Oswalt and Jordan Bloom, art by Scott Hepburn. While our team is trying to track down some clues in terms of what happened to the previous miniseries, Playtime is hitting a bunch of quagmires of her own, and it's all coming down. I can't believe this is the second to last issue of this book. That was a wild reveal to me at the end here, because I definitely thought there was more, but yeah, really good characterization, dark circumstances as usual, good, upsetting superhero universe.
Badass really, older lady. I mean, what's not the love?
I was going to say, Pete, right over the plate for you. Right over the page.
I love when she's like, thanks, Frank. And he's like, come on, call me Anchorman. You know what I mean? I mean, this is fun.
I feel like this book has, they just keep getting better at their pacing. Like, this is such a well-paced book, great action sequences. I love that there's this underpinning of, like, there's these, like, Teen Titans who are the villains, and then, like, the older people are like, fuck you guys, you're kids, stop it. And it's a great just ongoing battle. Bummer what happens to Wart.
Yeah.
Bummer what happens to Ward, but also badass battle in the old folks' home throughout the issue. Love this series. Great stuff. What If Aliens, number 4 from Marvel, written by Hans Rodionoff and Brian Volk-Weiss, art by Guy Villanova.
Rough Rider! Come on, Rough Riser, let's go. Rough Riser!
Yes, Rough Risers. Paul Reiser in this issue is trying to track down a bunch of aliens who have spawned, specifically an alien queen. There's some betrayals, there's some twists, there's some turns. I gotta be honest, putting this book in the stack, I was like, we're in too deep to turn back now. We gotta keep reading this at this point.
Yeah.
You not want to continue reading? This is a blast. I mean, this is Paul Reiser just doing it the best. This is just so much fun.
I don't know if you guys watched the trailer for Aliens Romulus that came out today, which looks messed up and upsetting and terrifying.
Does it have Paul Reiser in it?
Yeah.
It does not.
Definitely. Well, then what are we doing?
But that's the sort of thing that I want out of Aliens. This Goofmatron 2000 is, I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah, but sometimes it's fun to have a Goofmatron 2000. We've seen Aliens darker, scarier, you know, like this is a lighter take on this kind of thing in a Paul Reiser kind of way. And I think it's got a little sweet spot. There's a little Paul Reiser sweet spot here, and this is enjoyable.
There's no one goofier in entertainment
is hard. He says it right there. He says it right there in the comic.
He's sort of this generation's Robin Williams in a lot of ways.
Oh, well, let's take it easy then.
I don't know. This is definitely too strong, and I don't totally believe this, but I feel like it defags the aliens a little bit for Paul Reiser to be like, "Course, boy, here I am in their nest again."
Yeah, agreed.
That's the tone they're going for.
I know, but that's not aliens. Aliens is the thing that lives in my nightmares almost more than anything else. And like,
yeah,
so it can't ever do anything different.
They can. Like, Aliens 3 was different. Aliens Resurrection was different. It stretched the franchise, and I always like a franchise switch, but doing a thing where he's like, oops, aliens is...
Yeah.
A little too far for me.
What would you think, Pete, if at the end of this upcoming Aliens movie there was a blooper reel? Because this sort of feels a little bit like the blooper reel of...
But it has the Caddyshack music. The I'm all right.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we're looking for.
Singing the chorus, yeah.
A little alien out of somebody's chest doing like that.
I've seen that in a movie before.
Dance, yeah.
This whole thing is, it is weird. It's also weird just the way, like, he keeps, like, he's in the alien nest, and he's suddenly in the office. He's like, hey, guys, I was just getting an alien thing. And then he's like, oh, I gotta go get your mom. She's alive, but in cryo chamber. We gotta go get her. She's been taken. The aliens knew to kidnap the mom or the Utani guy. It was just like, it's crazy.
I'll throw out there on that note, like, that's the thing that happens at the end of the issue where he's like, oops, your mom is actually alive. Also, I lied to you about you can go off the planet. It didn't do anything to your lungs. There's the bones of a better story in here, but it's just going for bits. Like, I don't think it needs to be deadly serious. There could be jokes and whatever, but everything in here is built towards bits. That is what they are doing across the board with all of this. But the idea of, like, Carter Burke betraying his daughter, betraying his wife, that's interesting. If they weren't just building everything up to a punchline, I think it might work a lot better.
I think oops, your mom is a fun line.
It depends on where you hear it, I would say, Pete.
Poison Ivy, number 23 from DC Comics, written by G. Willow Winston, art by Henning. In this issue, Poison Ivy has already taken it to Jason Woodrue and is taking him down, but a bunch of her allies come together to help her, including, spoilers past this point, but a badass entrance from Harley Quinn. A surprising team up from Batman happens in this issue. This is really bringing things together in a great way. Janet from HR continues to be a standout. Very fun character. To contradict what I said just before, the bits with Janet from HR work here because they are tonally consistent with what's happening in the rest of the comic book. Great stuff.
Yeah, I loved Harley Quinn's moment in here where she's like, God, how do these weirdos keep showing up? Very funny. This is hilarious, well-drawn, well-executed. This is great. I don't want it to end. More, please.
It feels like it's going to keep going at least a little bit longer. I agree, the Janet, I feel like this Poison Ivy sort of dying has been going on for a while. So, like, I'm ready for that to turn, but, like, the Harley Quinn and Janet from HR stuff just buoys everything. The moment where Janet from HR is sort of like, well, what you guys have is bigger than what I have with either of you. And Harley's like, what the fuck did you say? And she's like, oh, nothing. Like, that's really funny. And then she's immediately like, I better go with him. I need to say some one-liners. That's my whole thing. And it's just like... it's just great comedy in the middle of this, like, death, like, extended death sequence, which is really cool.
The Last Mermaid, number 4 from Image Comics by Derek Kirk Kim. We are following, per the title, The Last Mermaid, as she travels this post-apocalyptic landscape with her axolotl, and now a dude with one eye who is not a mermaid and is helping her find her destination. I love the invention of this book. The art is absolutely stunning. The character dynamics are really interesting. I don't know what's going on with Lottie and our mermaid. There's just a surprising spoiler here, but paddle where Lottie kisses the mermaid and she blushes. I don't know. Yeah. Is there some romance there or something? I'm not sure, but
with the fish.
Yeah. But I am endlessly fascinated by this book.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different ships on the horizon here, so it'll be interesting to see where this pans out, to your point, but I'm having a blast, and the kind of landscapes are so beautiful and really impressive. The tone of this book, the pace of this book, everything that's happening. Yeah, I love this world. I think it's really impressive what they're doing, and I hope we get a lot more.
It'd be awkward to share a tank with your partner.
You think so? Mm. Sharing fluids, just sitting in them all day?
What do you think we're doing right now?
That's what I was getting at. It's like, guys, we've been in this tank for a little too long today. The water's a little warm. I just keep going through warm spots. P. LePage, I'm looking at you. P. P. LePage.
Hey, PLP. Come on, man.
PLPP. Let me just softly transition. This book is amazing. It's very beautifully done. And I agree with you, like, the sort of, like, there's, like, a lot of breathless rom-com stuff happening here, but I don't know what it is. So it's definitely a visual feast.
I liked how she was getting a little, you know, because she said something about, like, eyes, and she was like, oh, God, you only have one eye. So that was a fun kind of rom-com moment.
Good stuff. Definitely pick up this book. Space Ghost, number 2 from Dynamite, written by David Popose, art by Jonathan Lau. Mm. Space Ghost has, I don't know, adopted 2 kids, and they're all figuring out how to work together. This issue is the main thing. I continue to really like this series. This goes in directions that I've not been expecting. Jonathan Lau's art is great superhero art throughout.
Incredible.
What'd you guys think about this?
Yeah, I mean, the art is next level. It's really impressive, the layering. I mean, just the cape work alone is impressive. But, I'm having a blast with this. It's great to see, Blip and the gang here. And, I just think it's fun to see Space Ghost frustrated inventing, you know. I'd love to be able to fly up and punch a bunch of boulders in the sky. You know what I mean? It'd be really great stress reliever.
Nice. It's nice how quickly they all just fall in together in this issue. We get a lot of, like, Space Ghost is missing some people in his life. These guys are missing some people in their lives. What if they all just were friends and dressed alike? And
then sometimes if you just dress alike, it helps.
Oh, same. That's how I sneak into marching bands.
I agree, my bearded friends. Shazam, number 12 from DC Comics, written by Josie Campbell, art by Mike Norton and Emanuela Lupacino. In this issue, we're finally getting some clarity of what's been going on with the Captain and Billy Batson. And it goes in a direction that at least I was not expecting, that I loved in terms of the twist here. Great emotional stuff in this issue. Great Billy Batson stuff. Great the Captain / Shazam stuff. Great Shazam-y things.
Great art.
Yeah, just Josie Campbell is crushing this title. This is so good right now.
Agree. Like, I feel like Mark Waid came before Josie and established, like, sort of like a comedic, like, tone. But I love that Josie sort of took that up, but has added this great emotional underbelly to it that is just so well done in this issue. This is the best Shazam. I've been enjoying this Shazam more than any other Shazam in quite some time.
Wow. Yeah, I agree with all that. Super impressive. Love the emotion of it, and you can't say enough about the art.
Wow, Pete lost steam right here at the very end with the last review. Whoop, whoop. And for all of you out there, if you'd like to support this podcast and Pete's sleep schedule, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
And I'll see you inside Donatello's sexual shell.
Oh, boy.
Really, look up that article.
Why would you call that back?